Afternoon, the tax committee will come to order and welcome Mr. Hines. Members, we were trying to finally finish up the overview portion of the year. And so what we have left is the property tax area. So with that, Mr. Hines, if you can remind us, we, members, we had a couple things we asked you to save. One is this overview of property tax, which is the PowerPoint. The other one is the bigger overview of property tax. So we're working off these two documents. They should be in your folders. And Mr. Hines, can you tell us where we left off? And the pages have them if you can't find them. So just raise your hand for the pages. I'll bring you one. Mr. Hines.
Yes, Madam Chair, we left off with, we had just finished, I believe finished, the discussion of local government aid.
Mr. Hines, I want to interrupt you. Can you pull the mic closer to you? Yes, excuse thank me, you. Yes.
So we had just completed local government aid, and the next topic in our packet was county program aid. And on the lengthier document, that's on page 25. That begins on page 25, and it's slide number... it's slide number 25 also. So, county program aid is the county version, the county equivalent, you might say, of local government aid. It was originated in 2004. In the 2003 session, it was created, first going into effect in 2004. And it was a consolidation of a number of different aid programs for counties that were general purpose aids, although they did have some kind of an attention to certain subject matter, such as family preservation aid, criminal justice aid, etc. The 2004 distribution was really just the old distribution called under a new name, but in 2005 the actual county program aid formula was first used to distribute money. And the county program aid, which is basically, if you just think of it as a $200 million a year program, and it's, half of it is distributed under a need aid basis, and one half is distributed under tax-based equalization. So there's basically two formulas each that divide up $100 million for county program aid. Now that it had been 205 total. This year, 2009, it was scheduled to go to $227 million, and it has been certified at $227 million, but as you know, the governor has proposed that number not be fully funded. The need-based aid part of the formula basically uses three factors. One is the slide says it's a county age index, but it's really a population, but it's given population more heavily weighted towards counties with higher populations of over 65 or under 18. And then another part is based on the number of Part 1 crimes, and a third piece is the number of households receiving food stamps. So those three factors go into dividing up the need aid portion of the formula. And then the tax-based equalization aid part of the formula is tax-based and population are the two factors involved in that. The next slide, 28, then shows the amount of county program aid over going back to 2003. And you can see that in 2003, that's really the combination of the aid amounts that had been certified under the original program, PAC, attached machine aid, et cetera, that I mentioned at the earlier slide. In fact, after the reductions, the cuts that were made in 2003, $161 million was actually paid in 2003. For 2004, that was the year of the deep cuts from the last budget problem period, and was all the way down to $111 million, and then it went up to a sort of normal level of $205 million at sticky level up until 2009. It was scheduled to go up to $227. The bars show then the amount, the 2008 number reduced by the amount of unallotment for 2008, and then the 2009 we just show what the amount would be under the governor's recommendation.
Mr. Hines, excuse me. I want to call on Representative Loffler. And Representative Loffler, before your question, would you mind if you had a chance to look at the minutes of February 4th?
I would be delighted to move to February 4th.
Okay, so Representative Loffler moves the minutes of February 4th. Discussion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. The minutes are adopted. Representative Loffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hines, since it started with some program funding, with the consolidation of criminal justice aid and family preservation aid, it, you know, with counties, you have money in our budgets of public safety and health and human services and here, and it's been sort of this awkward hybrid, but have you and or the other program staff ever interrelated what's happening with those other funding streams with actual property tax levels into counties? I mean, the theory here is that it's property tax relief, but does it really ameliorate that if we have a year when we cut DDB into other funding streams to counties? Has that ever been brought together?
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, because Loeffler, I don't think we really had a decent study of trying to look at county program aid compared to property taxes. Ms. Dalton was involved in this, in some work in the early, pardon me? Well, the social service aids and how that related to tax bases, et cetera. And that she may want to comment on. But in general, you're right, there's always been this sort of confusion about how to deal with county aid for the tax committee, because so much of the county, the relationship between the state and the county is determined by the funding in the specific programs for, specifically for criminal justice and for social service, or for human services, that it's always been a little difficult to know how to even treat the to have a general purpose aid formula, and this was kind of the attempt to get something out there, but I don't know of any study that's tried to look at how these aids have really affected property tax burdens per se.
Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the three factors that kind of went into the need were actually factors that came out of either the county criminal justice aid formula or the family preservation aid formula. In the family preservation aid formula, we did actually kind of look at some of the health and human service spending and some of the factors related to it back when we set up that formula, but I don't think, to my knowledge, nobody's done anything since then, and that's the early 90s.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I just think this is an area where maybe need to start to figure out, even though it's kind of walking into a swamp a bit. It's, you know, the reality is we have a swamp of a budget, and health and human services is going to take a huge hit. Corrections probably will too. And if we're going to tell our taxpayers what the real impact is on the largest levy in their property tax bill, we really should probably have some kind of a sense of how these things might play together.
Thank you. Walking into a swamp. That's a good one. Haven't heard that one yet. That's a good way to define the budget deficit. Mr. Hines, unless there are further questions on county aid. Anyone else? Nope. Okay. Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, the next slide then is on the market value homestead credit. This is page 28 now in the bigger document. And most of you have some awareness, I think, of how the market value homestead credit works. It's kind of an unusual determination in that the amount of the credit actually goes down as the value of a home goes up. So it's a credit paid to each homeowner to reduce their property taxes, and as you can see from the table on the slide, the maximum amount it can be is actually $304, which occurs at a value of $76,000. And if you're any value of the home that's above $76,000 starts to take away from how much credit you get. So you can see that at $200,000, it's a little under $200. At $300,000, it's about $100. It actually goes to zero at $414,000 of home value. So it's just a set amount that's taken off the homestead, the tax bill, whatever it is. And most of us, or a lot of the discussion of market value homestead credit comes in the cuts that have been made and were made in the early part of this decade, and were part of the unallotment and are now part of the governor's proposal. And these are actually then the way the credit works is the auditors instructed to take that amount off the tax statement, that the state will reimburse the local taxing jurisdictions for that amount taken off the tax statement. And then, in fact, then when the state has held back on that reimbursement or unallotted or cut it, then the local jurisdiction wasn't fully compensated, but the credit, the taxpayer still gets the credit and it still reduces their property tax. This credit was $266 million for calendar year 8, and I believe that's the before on allotment amount. But it's a fairly sizable program. The related program, the agricultural market value credit, is applied to ag homestead property. Has a similar characteristic that as the value goes up, the amount of the credit goes down. Although in this case, the maximum the credit can be is $345, and it never goes below $230. So once you reach that $350,000 of value of land, then it stays at a flat $230, no matter how many acres you have or how much value you have. And this credit is also subject to the unallotment process if need be. We generally kind of group the two credits together and they're treated the same. I think we usually prescribe that the amount first be taken off the homestead credit, but that's more just the state accounting method. It doesn't really make any difference to the jurisdiction which payment is cut.
Excuse me, Representative Broad.
Madam Chair and Mr. Hines, do you guys have a good history of the market value credit? I'm wondering, in one of your House research briefs.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I don't, in terms of a magnitude of dollars, a history, or because the program has been identical since it was created in 2001. The structure of the program, the parameters have not changed since the initial creation in 2001.
And, Mr. Hines, was it created as part of the restructuring of the tax reform?
Mr. Hines. Chair, Representative Broad, very much so. It was part of the whole going to a flatter class rate system, especially with regard to homes, to go to the straight 1% on home value all the way up to $500,000. This was an attempt to preserve some of the preference that had existed in the past for lower valued homes by giving this credit on that was more heavily, got a bigger credit on a lower valued home. Yes.
Okay. Just last follow-up, and I'm curious how the discussions related to PTR, and rather than doing originally why they went with market value credit versus putting more money into direct tax relief for individuals versus indirect tax relief.
Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I'm sure that was part of the discussion back then, as it usually is. Those programs are certainly, wise to think about those at the same time as what you're really trying to achieve. One thing we do always find when we look at things like that is many people in lower valued homes do not necessarily have low incomes, and if you assume that you can toss more tax burden on them and let the PTR pick it up, it doesn't really work out that way because of there's many in that situation. I think another aspect is so much of tax policy around here can be governed by the runs and people's tax statements, and it's a lot more tangible. You could say what a tax statement's going to look like under a reform with something like the market value credit in it. Once you get to the PTR, you can't really say because you don't sort of know people's income. So I think in the discussion, we tend to sort of, it's a little harder to bring those dollars into the picture, and instead you look at if you take away taxes, those taxes go up for those taxpayers, and you can allege that some, most, all of it will be bought off by the PTR, but you don't really have any way of saying that very, very confidently.
One last question. Is it your opinion then that the PTR is a more direct form of tax relief? Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, this is Broad. I'm not sure I would say that. It's a more directed in terms of you're thinking more about different, you're thinking about both the person's property tax burden and their income when you direct money to them through the PTR. But it's certainly a direct relief program to sort of take the money right off the bottom line of their tax statement. So I guess I wouldn't have said that. But
Mr. Hines, I was just trying to remember who the conferees were in 2001. And this was Terry Abrams' proposal, as everyone knows. And I was a conferee, and I believe Representative Wayne was a conferee, although maybe I don't recall. I think in Representative McElroy and then another rural member, but a lot of what I recall, and I'm happy to be corrected by anybody here, is that when the change to take over the state funding of education happened, there was some properties that received dramatic relief, much more than even anticipated. And so there was a lot of moving things around, whether it was cabins or utilities or some of these. Ag market value credit was created, and extension market value credit was created, and that was to, you know, I can offer to backfill the old HECA was part of the discussion too. And, you know, I obviously wasn't privy to designing it, but I remember a lot of the discussions around it, and I think a lot of it was trying to do significant property tax reform without having any kind of property see dramatic, significantly dramatic swings one way or another. So I really can't speak to all the moving pieces. Representative Blaney might want to get in on this, but I think Representative Broad has helped us all. People think this ag market value credit and the market value credit has been around forever. It's an infant.
Right.
I mean, it's only been around for a very short time. But I do think that most people, when they're breaking the buckets of property tax aids and credits to local units of government versus individual, mean these two market value credits and the circuit breaker and targeting kind of all tied together. But if Representative Lanning has a thought on this, I'd be interested in hearing what he thinks about all of this. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. 2001 was before my time. I was a member of the conference committee in 2003,
okay.
my first term here, but if I had been on the committee and in the conference committee in 2001, I would have argued for a different result in that reform package. I had always had some problems with what was done.
Okay. May I ask Mr. Michael and Ms. Dalton or somebody else if they can recall? Put the pressure on. I mean, you know, I think it's just helpful for all of us to think about this. We always hear in the public that everybody's been here since the beginning of time and nothing ever changes and, geez, we need term one. Look around the room. I mean, it's hard to find somebody who was part of a discussion, a major property tax reform only, you know, 8 years ago. Mr. Michael, want to take a shot?
Madam Chair, conference committees come and go, and I cannot remember who the members of the 2001 conference committee were, despite the fact that it went well into June before it was done.
Ms. Dalton, got a guess?
Madam Chair, I'm Neil, Ron Abrams, McElroy, yourself, and I don't know. I don't think Representative Earhart was on the committee.
I think it would have been two Greater Minnesota members as my guess for balance. Representative
Ms. Manzi just suggested perhaps Representative Queasley.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
It was. Yes. Anyone else? Well, I think it's just a good discussion because members, you know, the public often doesn't know how many people have been here just a few years, and this committee is another example of that. Representative Brock.
Well, I mean, Karen, I don't need to phone a friend on the answer to that question. I guess part of the reason I was asking the questions is that I didn't have a great history on this program, and we often hear this program talked about in the same realm with LGA. And when we think about direct versus indirect property tax relief and what goes to individuals versus what goes to cities, I think it's important to have the structure right in terms of how we view it, whether it's direct or indirect, and which one actually it links up with, because we tend to discuss this one as more of an indirect property tax relief. And if I'm hearing Mr. Hines correctly, it's not. It's very direct.
Thank you. Agreed. Representative Marquardt, before Ms. Dalton gets to Representative Marquardt. If you want to jump in here, I think we should get the property tax here in on this.
You know, this type of market value homestead credit is entirely new, but prior to that, we did have homestead tax preferences, if you will. I mean, I remember back at least in the late 80s, early 90s, you could get 54% of your taxes up to like $700. And then right towards the end, there was an education homestead credit that used to be ratcheted up a little bit. I think it was like 83% of your education taxes before they... So that might be, Representative Broad, why some people maybe talk... I know it's not, like you said, Madam Chair, it's a totally new program, but we've had this kind of homestead preference. I don't know how long that goes back into... maybe some of those who go way, way back could do that. And, but we kind of had these preferences for quite a while.
How many way back do you want an answer?
Way back, way, way back, or way, way back?
For me, almost go back as far as local government aid. Probably not that far, but I
would
further that.
Our members, and we will keep going, but now that we've had the way, way back comments, we're going to go to Mr. Michael and see if he can tell us his insight. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hines could help on that. He's been as long, around as long as I have, too. But the home, there are basically three periods here. There's the homestead credit era, there's the Hacker era, and then there's the market value credit era. And the homestead credit area, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think that that was instituted when the sales tax was imposed in 1967. And then it was ratcheted up many times, as we know from our careers here, until it was eliminated in the early 90s, or 89 actually was the bill, and it was implemented in the 90s. And I think it is at its apex, it was at a 58% rate at one point that got ratcheted back down to the 54% that Representative Marquardt referenced, and I don't remember what the height of the maximum was, but like the homestead market value credit that Representative Broad was talking about, that was a deduction from the taxpayer's tax bill, and it was a fraction or a percentage of the tax that was due. So it was, you know, very direct, and the concern always was that that actually created a perverse incentive for local governments to levy higher, because a fraction of their home tax for their homeowners would be paid by the state. The HACA period was sort of that was more like a block grant aid that really wasn't directly tied to, you know, what home taxes were, although it was sort of started out as a grandfather, and then it was adjusted to, as a way to pay for class rate changes without having a shift onto other property. And then the market value credit was sort of a reversion back to something closer to the homestead credit, but because it's not related to the tax, the local tax levy, it really doesn't have the concern about the incentive effect of the old homestead credit.
Yeah.
But
okay, Representative Fulbert.
But the market value credit doesn't apply to every tax year, right?
That's correct. Mr. Hines. Well, the chart,
Mr. Chairman.
We can go back a slide and we can look at it.
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chairman, Representative Fulbert, it applies to every homestead other than anything over $414,000 of value, but every other homestead, yes.
Okay, so further questions on either of the market value credit programs? If not, Representative Wofford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to figure out who these different ones apply to, and reading the ag market value credit says it only applies to homesteads, but then it's based on the property excluding the value of the homestead. So does that mean that if you're an owner-occupied farmer, you live on your land and you have a home there, that you get both?
Madam Chair, Representative,
yeah. Mr. Hines.
Whopper, yeah. You get one for the one based on the value of the house garage in 1 acre, the famous homeowner in town, and then you get one on the land that doesn't, of course, then take the value of the home, doesn't pay for that, that's just related to the land. And to go back to sort of bring another part of the whole discussion of how things used to be, it used to be that we had the homestead credit did spill over onto the ag land, and there was an ag credit on the ag land that didn't go to the house. And so part of the whole, in fact, it sort of shows up in the design of this agricultural market value credit, this very steep credit on the first kind of low amount of farm value has to do with still preserving this preference that had gotten created through having these two different credits spill over onto that ag land, that those very small value, small farms, small valued farms got very, you know, a very high level of credit. And each time we've tried to reform the system, in the end we've sort of gone back to try to recreate some element of that because of a fear of raising taxes on somebody if we didn't. So that's maybe a trip down memory lane. We didn't even want to go there. But those of us who have been working in it a long time, I always have to design fixes for these problems, are well aware of it. Great. And I think Ms. Mandy is going to talk about PTR. PTR is one of those things that lots of us in health research work on, and Ms. Baker probably would have talked about it. She's not here today, but anyway.
Ms. Mandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi from Health Research, and before I start describing the program, I want to follow up a bit on Representative Broad's question. And in 2001, when the market value homestead credit came into being, the homeowner property tax refund was also expanded. So there was money put into both places, both targeted directly to individuals and then tied to the value of the home. So the property tax refund program, there are refunds for both homeowners and renters. Both of them are intended to provide relief to people whose property taxes are high relative to their income. As we heard the other day in the governor's budget presentation a little bit, the renter property tax refund is based on property taxes that are assumed to be a percentage of rent. Under current law, 19% of the rent that you pay is assumed to represent your property taxes. For homeowners, the program uses the actual property taxes paid. The way it works is that if property taxes are greater than a threshold percentage of your income, then the refund equals a percentage of that amount over the threshold up to a maximum amount. That's a lot of words there. So I'll start off with some detail about income. First of all, the measure of income used is a very broad measure that we sometimes refer to as household income. It includes most forms of non-taxable income. So it includes non-taxable Social Security benefits, non-taxable pension income, and other things like that. The idea is that we're trying to measure your ability to pay property taxes. And a person who has income consisting primarily of non-taxable Social Security benefits has the same ability to pay as a person who has the same amount of income consisting of taxable wages. So household income includes both of those kinds of income. Then the threshold that your property taxes have to exceed for you to be eligible for the program, that threshold increases as your income increases. And the thinking behind that is that as your income increases, you have a greater ability to pay more of it for property taxes. The next part is that you get a percentage of the tax over your refund. I mean, percentage of the tax over the threshold is a refund, and that percentage is sometimes called the copay. And the percentage that you get as a refund decreases as your income goes up. So the state has less need to target relief to higher income people who are still eligible based on their taxes compared to that threshold of income than it does to people who are lower income. Finally, the maximum refund amount decreases as income increases. So the whole three pieces of it there are meant to target the relief more towards people at the lower end of the income range with higher incomes who the formula presumes have greater need for relief than people at the higher end of the scale. The next slide shows the dollar amount of refunds for claims filed in 2007. And it breaks it out for homeowners and renters, and also breaks it out by senior disabled homeowners and senior disabled renters. You can see the total amount for both the renter and homeowner program is just under $600 million. The average refund is about, well, I'm sorry, that's not right. That's the number of filers, just under 600,000 filers. So it's a lot of people in the state. And then the total refund amount is $363 million. The average is about $612. The next slide shows the income limits and the maximum refunds for claims that will be filed in 2009. For homeowners, incomes up to just under $100,000 are eligible, and the maximum refund is just over $2,300. So someone at $96,939 of income is not going to be eligible for a $2,300 refund. The refund for someone up at that income level, the maximum will be more like $50 or $40. That maximum will cap out at lower income levels and then start decreasing. For renters, the maximum income eligible is just over $50,000, and the maximum refund is about $1,500. Those maximum income amounts and the maximum refund amounts are both adjusted annually for inflation. The homeowner refund program was most recently changed last session, where the thresholds were lowered for higher income homeowners. And then the next program, so that's all that we have on the homeowner and renter property tax refunds, unless there are questions.
Before questions, I just want to tell members that Ms. Bergman has, our crack staff, of course, has been working away, and the conferees were, of course, two from the metro and two greater Minnesota, and the majority party. They were from Minnetonka, Representative Abrams, and from Burnsville, Representative McElroy. Greater Minnesota was the Rochester area and Strong Communities, Representative Cleasley. And the final one, and she was actually the chair of the Sales and Income Tax Division, which used to exist, Representative Daggett from 3AZ. So that would have been the trivial pursuit question here today. So thank you, Ms. Bergman. Okay, so questions on the property tax refund. Was it Representative Lanning? Yes, Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manzi, do we have numbers of the amounts of the refunds that different income categories get, like those between 75 and 97,000? Is that possible that we can break out how much of the refunds go to different income categories?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I don't have that information with me, and I don't think I have it upstairs, but that is something that the Department of Revenue should be able to tell us when they complete the VOS database, which was funded last year in the tax bill. And I think they're scheduled to have some preliminary results to that point, I think, sometime in March. So that's something that I'll follow up with Revenue on, but we should be able to get that kind of information in session.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to see it also for the renter's credit, you know, on the different income categories, to see how much of the money goes to the different income categories. Thank you.
Okay. Special targeting. Come on. I don't know. Ms. Andy, are you continuing?
Yeah. Sure. Please. The special property tax refund is known as targeting. This is a property tax refund program that is not tied to income. It provides relief to homeowners who have a large property tax increase from 1 year to the next. So your tax has to increase by at least 12% from 1 year to the next, and then you're eligible for a percentage of that as a refund up to a maximum amount. And that is in the details piece here. And the percentage is 60% up to a $1,000 maximum. And I should have known those because we haven't changed them in quite a long time. I would also mention that in the detailed packet, there are, for the homeowner and renter property tax refunds, there are some tables showing calculations of refund amounts, for example, homeowners and renters. And there's also a table showing a calculation of this targeting property tax refund for an example homeowner. For the returns filed in 2007, there was just under $8 million paid in targeting to about 100,000 taxpayers. This is the program where the number of claims tend to fluctuate from 1 year to the next, depending on what happens with property taxes overall. So if homeowner property taxes go up a lot in 1 year, then there are a lot of people over that 12% increase threshold for the targeting program. If property taxes remain relatively flat, then there are fewer people who are eligible for the program. The increase excludes a portion of the increase that pertains to improvements that the homeowner has made to the home. So if someone puts on an addition and their taxes go up a lot because of that, they're not going to get targeting for that part. It's just the increase that otherwise would have occurred.
Thank you. Representative Holder.
Does that also include the increase in market value, period? If a professor comes on and increases the market value of a great deal, and then also when we're phasing out limited market value.
Madam Chair, Representative Fulbert, the increase in market value, it would depend on what the, and Mr. Hines may help me with this, but it would depend on what happened to the assessment of all the other properties in the jurisdiction as to whether or not that translated to an increase in property taxes. if it did, then they would be eligible for targeting because of that. And I believe it's also the case that as their property taxes would go up, as more of their value moves off of limited market value onto the tax rolls, then if that results in an increase that goes over that 12% threshold, then they're eligible for the targeting refund.
And that's a one-time eligibility, not for 1 year.
Ms. Angie.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, it's on that particular increase, it's just for 1 year. If you have a 12% increase from the second year to the third year, then you're again eligible for the program.
I understand that, but it's not an ongoing automatic.
Well, simple, right. It's not automatic. However, if you are somebody whose values are going up year after year, you're going to get it. Right. You have to have, I think, a minimum of $100 change also as well. And I think it does help address the limited market value phasing out, but it the fact this is the only one that's not income based, so it certainly comes into play for people of lower income who property values are going up very fast, more than 12%. They can file for this as well. But it also, another way I think about it is people like Representative Downey and Moon and Rood and others, most of their constituents really couldn't qualify for anything that we've talked to until we got to this slide, where you can say, that there is no household income limit, but you may see someone's valuation sort of jump overnight, and they can qualify for a refund. So it does limit the market value jump. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Anzi, with the exception of you cited the exception of if you make an improvement to a house and the assessed value goes up for that, are there other exceptions that for property tax increases that would not be as being eligible for targeted?
Ms. Anzi.
Madam Chairman, Representative Garofalo, not really. You have to be a homeowner both years. So to change from, move into a place or move into a different place, it obviously has to be the same house only. But generally, I think the improvement is the only exclusion per se. And to kind of pick up on what Representative Solberg was mentioning, it doesn't matter if the increase is because of value increase or local spending increase or a combination. It just looks at the bottom line for the 2 years.
Madam Chair, so voter approved levies, stuff like that you're still eligible for targeting even in
correct.
Those situations?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions on targeting? If not, we'll move on.
Madam Chair, I just have one remaining thing to add about the targeting program, and that's that the targeting refund is calculated before the homeowner property tax refund. So an individual homeowner might be eligible for both programs. First, you look at whether the increase has been more than 12% from 1 year to the next. Then you deduct that refund amount from your property taxes paid. You take the balance of what you have to pay after you get the targeting refund and see if that gets you over the threshold for your income level, if you then qualify for the homeowner refund. So there are people who qualify for both of those refunds.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, the next slides that we have are, as was done with the state taxes, we wanted to bring in a few slides from the incident study on the incidence of the property tax. And this information begins on page 38 of the more in-depth document. And it shows the first slide shows the effective tax rate of property taxes by quintiles, by population quintiles, and the bar for each quintile, you'll see two colors on the bar chart. The first the longer bar indicates what the tax burden would be absent property tax refund, and then the dark shade is the net property taxes after property tax refunds are taken into account. And so you can see that with the after property tax refund, the percentages are somewhat flat. The first quintile 3.9%, then the next two are 3.3, 3.2, the fifth quintile 2.3%. But you can see that the bar would be quite a bit different in those two lowest quintiles if you look at the tax before the property tax refund. So the property tax refund does have a big impact on the incidence of the property tax. burden. And the next chart just shows the distribution and of the net tax through the quintiles. And this, I should have mentioned that this is the incidence of the property tax really comes from a number of different sources. It's not just the tax on your home. It's the tax on the businesses that you are employed by, that you purchase from, that you, if you're a renter, it gets to a landlord, part of the tax and the part borne by the renters. All of that is attempted to be taken into account by the tax incident study, what I've presented is the result of all of the different contributions of the property tax to your overall tax burden.
Questions? Okay. We have mining, levy limits, and special levy, and then we're done. Mining taxes. Correct. Mr.
Hines. Mining taxes, and again, this is an area that Karen is a little more closer to than I am, but as we sort of, I think it came up in the previous meeting, the taconite industry does not pay the traditional property tax, and instead the mines and the facilities that are involved in taconite production pay production taxes and an occupation tax in lieu of paying a property tax. So I think the production tax is in lieu of the property tax, and we think of the occupation tax as in lieu of the income tax. The amount paid for 2008, the amount of production tax paid was $112 million. This is distributed. The best way to maybe see how it's distributed is if you look on the longer document on page 40, there's a table at the bottom of the page which shows where that money goes to. And so it's similar to a property tax in that it goes to the cities, towns, school districts, counties, etc. Although in addition, there are some of the property, the production tax revenues are paid to the Iron Range Resource Board, and then that is has separate funding for an environmental protection fund, an economic development fund, etc. And then there's one part of the production tax that's actually a taconite homestead credit that's paid to homeowners in the taconite relief areas, in addition to the cities and towns and school districts and counties that receive some aid. And those are all formulas that drive those distributions.
All right.
And
levy limits.
Oh.
Representative Dabney wants to take on mining taxes.
Let's have that wise, Madam Chair. question, in it, the mining industry does not pay property tax, according to the slide. Do they pay the statewide business property tax?
Members of Debbie, no, they do not.
Thank you very much.
The CI property tax, no, they do not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton, levy limits. Is that what you're going to talk to us about?
Madam Chair, yes, I am going to be talking about levy limits. Director, I'm Pat Fulton with House Research. I would also direct you to, I'm trying to find out what page. Page 41 of the larger document has a little bit more detail about levy limits. Levy limits is one of the programs that goes back way, 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 way back to the Minnesota Miracle. They were first imposed in 1972 as part of the Minnesota Miracle. And they were first removed in 1993 when truth and taxation notices were enacted as a replacement to levy limits. And so when people talk about, why do we have truth and taxation and the cost of that, you have to remember that, this was actually a trade-off at one point. Eliminate levy limits, impose truth and taxation. Levy limits were off for 5 years in the 90s, then were reimposed. And there's actually a little table on page 41 that shows when they've been enacted and when they have been off. They've been off for a total of 9 years since 1972, and they were reimposed last year for 3 years, beginning with K 2009.
Levy limits apply to all counties and to cities with a population of 2,500 or more, which is only about 200 of the 855 cities. So over 600 of the cities are not subject to levy limits. The base for levy limits are levies, general purpose aid, LGA county program aid, cash and aid, and one thing which is relatively new, and that's the Wind Energy Production Tax, which is similar to tax night aid. It's paid instead of property tax on the wind energy production. The levy plus aid amount, which is called the levy limit base, is allowed to grow for three things. It's allowed to grow for inflation in state and local government purchases, up to a maximum of 3.9%. That's why everyone's got in their mind the 3.9% levy limits this year. That's a little unusual from previous law. Normally it had just been whatever the inflation rate has been. So capping the inflation rate is kind of a new thing. The other two factors is it's allowed to increase for half of the percentage growth in new households. Previously it's always been the percentage increase in new households. Well, this is only half of the standard growth rate that's been allowed. And the final factor is half of new commercial industrial property, or the increase in tax base due to new commercial industrial property. And that has actually been a traditional allowed growth. It's half of that growth. Clearly, because the aids are included in the levy, as aids go up, your levy authority goes down, and as your aids decrease, your levy authority increases, which is why for pay 2010, if there is a cut prior to them establishing their levy, they will be allowed to levy back the 2010 cut, as long as they know it in advance. The interesting thing about levy limits is they do not limit all levies. There's a number of special levies allowed outside of levy limits. The laundry list is fairly large. It's on page 42, and even that is kind of a collapsed list. But essentially, things that local governments can levy for outside of levy limits are debt, matching grants, increases in matching grants, not all matching grants, but any increases in matching grants, requirements. They can levy for natural disasters. They can levy for increased costs in jail operations that are required, either by rule or court mandates. They can levy for pension increases that occurred after 2001. And then there were three new special levies included in the levy limits passed this year. One was for increased health and human service cuts due to some federal health and human service cuts made last year. So it's not any time the federal government cuts health and human service grants, but only for the ones that actually occurred last year. They can levy for increased public safety compensation, and this is both cities and counties, police, fire, and sheriff. And it covers both new cops or new firemen, or it covers just increases in wages and benefits to existing public safety personnel. And finally, there are some costs related to abandonment and foreclosures that they can special levy for. Mm-hmm. And this, you have to have extraordinarily high number of abandonments or foreclosures, and that was worked out with some of the housing people last year.
Ms. Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Dodd, is there a way to understand how much of city budgets are actually outside of the levy limit?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, we do actually have some information on that. I don't have it with me right now, but I certainly get it. We do actually require local governments to report, even when levy limits are not in place, we require them to report their levies separated out into things that would normally be subject to levy limits and what would, if levy limits were imposed, what would be in the special levy.
Further questions? And Representative Garofalo, I know you always try to do that still for the little puppies or whatever.
Yeah.
Please don't do that. Because, yeah, seriously, that's not... I just see in here, I cannot believe there's levy limits for the Animal Humane Society. Where did that come from, Ms. Dalton? Maybe we should call that Representative Garofalo's... I'm just pointing out you already have the Animal Humane Society is exempt from levy limits right here, which I did not know. Ms. Dalton, where did that come from?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I cannot remember the representative who sponsored the bill, but the bill was actually sponsored in a year that levy limits were not in effect, and it was passed as a preemptive measure. So if levy limits were reimposed, they could have the special levy.
Mr. Michael thinks it might be Representative Nornis. Does that ring a bell for you? Does anybody remember that? Representative Downey's taking it. We'll find out. We can't blame you, Representative Graswell. We'll find out, though. Okay, questions on special levies? And for newer members of the committee, a lot of members who are not on this committee call them the off-ramps. It's very confusing. That's what they're talking about. In this committee, we don't usually call them that, but a lot of members refer to these as the off-ramps. Okay, anything else?
Madam Chair, I actually think it was Representative Luther.
Representative Luther we can blame. Okay, well, we'll just... Yes.
The confusion with the bill I have is actually... from Representative Luther, so that might be part of the confusion. I don't, because...
You already have an off-ramp.
My bill is not an off-ramp. Mine is that we exempt it from the sales tax. You'll hear all of
these members who weren't on this committee, he brought all these little animals in here and got everyone to get real emotional to try to pass the bill. Well, thank you. Okay, further questions. Representative Rubina.
A county gets some these cuts, and it affects programs for the elderly, like snow shoveling and that, which they had hired people to do, and I know Meals on Wheels, those types of programs, and they can't levy for those, but we can levy for the dog catcher. Is that correct?
Ms. Dalton,
Madam Chair, Representative Bukovina, that would be correct.
Now you know why I bite instead of just bark. Can I ask a question relating to the Health and Human Service answer?
Yes.
If a city or city has a city-owned hospital like Representative Dillon and I have, and there are federal, and the loss of federal dollars due to the governor's budget with some matching state dollars, can a city levy under that Health and Human Service exemption?
Madam Chair, Representative Lucavina, I don't have the language right in front of me, but I do believe it was, number one, the Health and Human Service special levy was limited to counties, and it's only for increased costs faced by the counties due to some federal Health and Human Service grant reductions that occurred last year. Mm-hmm. It doesn't count for anything that occurred prior to that or anything that might occur in the future or reductions to federal money because the state is changing.
Well, Madam Chair, last year we cut hospital aids, and because of the cut in hospital aids and in the budget balancing bill, we lost federal dollars. So I would assume then that a county hospital could levy back that money that was lost under this, unless it was, you're saying it had to be a specific grant?
Madam Chair, this special levy is not for things that occurred, or for federal reductions that occurred because the state changed its actions. It's only for reductions in federal grants that occurred at the federal level, where the federal government made some changes in Health and Human Service policy.
And finally, Madam Chair, well, I have before Representative Abney, the mining companies pay a corporate income tax called occupation tax, which is distributed to K-12 and the University of Minnesota and General Fund. Just so you know that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abney.
Representative Rukavina, do they pay the statewide business property tax?
They don't pay the statewide property tax because they don't pay a property tax. They don't pay a property tax per se. But if you want to see what's going on in Minneapolis because of mining, I'll be glad to tell you later on about that $600 million a year that comes into research at the university, that at least 15% of those professors that are endowed chairs and bring in all that money are endowed by the mineral tax the university gets annually. Including, I can give you a list, because I get it every year, of students that get a scholarship from the Iron Range Scholarship Fund, which is also from that money that live in your district. So I'll get you that list, too. Then you can tell me what you give me.
Madam Chair,
nothing but
good.
That's great. That's great.
Absolutely great. I would remind Representative Rukavina that the University of Minnesota is a statewide asset with locations across the state and economic impact across the state, and is not a Minneapolis institution. I see a couple of Minneapolis lobbyists in the back. If they find that it's a department of the city of Minneapolis, you know, if I'm in error, they can certainly come forward. And I do remember, isn't Pasquale Benoit send the money north?
Mr. Madam Chair, Representative Dan, perhaps you could tell me this. Why does the Minsky system, when we see there in the capital bonding bill, their total amount, when they match that one-third we require of them, is, so it looks like Minsky is getting one-third more money than they're paying for one-third of it. The university, it's counted after they get the money. Their one-third isn't in there. So actually, right off the bat in the bonding bill, the university is getting way more money than the Minsky system, but it doesn't show up that way, number one. Number two, if you want to talk, why do everybody sitting around the table from the metro area when a community college or a technical college gets money in the bonding bill, that's for Pine City or Granite Falls or whatever, but when it's for the university, it's for all of us. If you want to see how much money is spent on the St. Paul and Minneapolis campuses versus the other three campuses, I'll show you that sometime too. And most of that six, in fact, all of the endowed chairs, I think there's maybe two or three at Duluth, and the rest of them are in Minneapolis or St. Paul with their mineral money. So you want to have a food fight in front of everybody, let's go, buddy. I got another something in my pocket to whip at you here.
Representative Dabney, then Representative
Maury. Hold it. I think I've got a better pack.
Yeah.
Am I? Yes, I do. I've got a better. No. It's a half and half thing.
Food fight.
I'll give you the skills that upset my guy.
No.
So my dad was a product.
Both of those products don't pay tax. Prescription drugs and food.
And don't say it's Viagra because it is.
That's gonna be a school softener.
It's an antibiotic and it's making me sick.
Representative,
Mr. Dean, I'd point out that the label includes take with food, which might help the stomach upset. But there was my dad who was a pharmacist, not me. As for a discussion, I think you might ask the chair of the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee about the different treatment of bonding proposals from the university and Minsky systems, and also for some greater insight into the differences between the two systems and their impact on both the local and state economy.
Okay, so we're a little far afield, but Representative Maury, did you want to defend your fair city here? Representative Maury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Rukavina, I think we should look at the percentage of people from Minneapolis that are attending whatever river college you referred to as compared to the people from the Iron Range and percentage of people in Minneapolis attending the University of Minnesota.
Okay, so members, I think that was fun.
Yes, challenge my friends from Minneapolis and St. Paul to show me where they're getting the money that we give to you every year because of the hard work of our people building the Permian University Fund trust to over $350 million. The Iron Range Scholarship trust to over $30 million. These are just the endowments. And the permanent school fund to over $500 million of money that every year gets distributed to everybody in the state.
And Representative Rubino, I want to thank you for dragging Representative Lesch and Representative Murphy into this fight. I'm mentioning St. Paul, Representative Lesch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I challenged her many years ago already, but
I'd
just like to state for the record that I'm consistently in awe of the massive resources sent to St. Paul from the Iron Range, and I want to personally thank Representative Rubino for that.
An honest man.
Okay.
Members, is it edible?
Okay, so the good news is the overview is done. Members, I do want to just quickly say that we would like to take tax committee on the road a couple times in the evening. Cancel day meetings, go in the evening. We don't have a budget. The tax committee actually spent almost none of its budget the last 2 years and gave it to the deficit. So that's why we didn't do a lot of that. So we can't do overnights and we can't pay for rooms, and so that means we kind of have to stay close in. But I thought it would be good to go to the Southwest Metro and maybe the North or East Metro, maybe in the core. If people can think of a way we can go to greater without spending any money, I'm all ears. But generally that means we need to put the whole committee up in hotels and bring the staff and all that. So it's kind of hard. But if your community is interested, please let me know. I have scheduled one. It will be February 24th in the evening, and I use my community because I knew I could get the $164 an hour room for free. So we'll be able to go there for free, and, you know, we all are here during the week. It's a Tuesday night. For some members, it will be on the way. For rural members, you know, they're here. They're trapped. For Metro members, it will be on the way home if you live in the western half of the Metro. So I think we'll see good attendance from those folks, like a lot of people here and over here. But I would imagine some of the people living east and north will say, I don't want to drive out there. So would like to try to see if anybody has an east location or northern location or core city, because we're really constrained if we're not going to have travel resources to take the committee on the road and just kind of see what people have in their minds. So got one and would love to go, you know, anywhere people want to go. So if any of you would like us to come to you, please come and talk to me. See if you can get a location, you know, fairly big with mics and your local cable maybe, and a free room is going to be sort of critical, because we really don't want to use taxpayer money to do this. So if with that, I think unless there's anything else, we are going to pick up the governor's budget tomorrow. We spent the whole committee last time on one governor's budget, which I think was important. It was the corporate tax cut, but now we have to get through everything else. There's a lot of other things going on with taxpayer, and we'll be doing that tomorrow. So thank you, members. We'll see you tomorrow. We are adjourned.